Good morning, everybody. We'll start as we always do, creating the situation that we're going to be in during the teachings. Okay? So when we visualize the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us, we are imagining being in a pure land, receiving the teachings from the Buddha. And that is very helpful for our mind. I don't know about your mind, but it's very helpful for my mind. But what we're doing when we have a teaching is we are, putting ourselves in a different kind of ambience. Now, where we're sitting with in the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas together with other practitioners. And we can think of all the sentient beings around us in human form, imagining that they are interested in the Dharma and are taking refuge and generating both bodhicitta too. So that kind of visualization is very powerful for changing the state of our mind, okay? I think it works better than Prozac, because if you imagine yourself in that situation, plus you're receiving teachings on Shantideva's text, then that's definitely better than Prozac, isn't it? So it's just, it changes the mind, that it's not just the humors and the body that change the mental attitude. Those may have a condition for things, but they're not the direct cause. But what is the direct cause is our mental state and what we've habituated ourselves with in the past. So when we do this visualization, we are implanting that seed in our mind, habituating ourselves with it, so it comes easier and easier, and one day we will wind up in the actual Pure Land, okay? And that is because of this habituation, and the habituation comes because of our present state of mind and how we are directing our mind. Okay, so if we create the Pure Land in front of us and imagine being in it at least during the duration of the teachings, then our whole mental attitude changes, doesn't it? Some of you are not so sure. Anyway, but if you take Prozac, you're sure that will work. Check out. That's what Lama Yeshe used to say to us sometimes. You guys think this. Check up, dear. So check up. And see how, what object you put your mind on, and how you habituate yourself with certain objects that you put your attention on, how that creates what you experience and how that creates your moods, whether your mind is joyful, whether your mind is, down and discouraged. Okay, so just observe and see. And I'm not saying, I have to clarify because some people are sensitive about this, I'm not saying don't take Prozac, if you need it. And because there's a clinical, chemical thing going on, that's fine. But I think it's, we need to put effort into creating a better image of the world that and the environment that we're in. Okay? Because if we... And this is, I'm going off on a tangent, but I think it's a useful one. You know, for example, with the non-virtue of malice, okay, the ninth of the ten non-virtues, if you have malice, it creates the cause to be reborn in a hell realm. Here you can see the real direct effect. If we have malice, okay, the mind is projecting everything bad on other people outside of us, okay? We hate them. We want to destroy them. We want to interfere with their happiness, okay? So this way of thinking, it comes right back to us in the form of the hell realm. And it comes back to us also in this lifetime, because if we are constantly projecting negativity and that these people are trying to harm me, then we're always experiencing suspicion of other people. We're always experiencing fear and insecurity, okay? And that's created because when we have hostility, then we see everybody around us are hostile, and so then we're suspicious and we're afraid of them. Yeah. So it works not just psychologically in this lifetime, but it works for, you know, we habituate that view of seeing the world in a certain way, and then we get born into the world that we created with our mind. Okay, so that hopefully is a good reason to abandon malice. Which, you know, and malice is very prominent nowadays in the lead up to the election. So we have to be quite careful about that. Yeah, but we can really see, and that is why it is called mind training. We have to train our mind, yeah, and not let these in afflictions that we're so habituated with arise. Because these afflictions are erroneous. They are wrong consciousnesses. They are not seeing the situation accurately. Okay, so it's like hallucinating, and then we get so familiar with our hallucination that we think it's real. Okay, so this is, you know, so much of what we're trying to do in Dharma practice. And at first it seems like, oh, wait a minute, I'm just like living in make-believe. Yeah, I'm just creating a make-believe situation. Yeah, you know, in one way, yeah, it is make-believe. We aren't in the pure land yet. But if we train our mind to see other living beings in a positive light, yeah, then our own mind is happier. We have better relationships with people. We can still see, you know, what the problems are. We can still see, you know, the faults that exist. But we aren't trapped by a vision where everything is a fault and everything is dangerous and where we have to protect the I at all costs. Okay. So if we create a new vision, you know, we're in Amitabha's pure land. Yeah, in Amitabha's pure land, you can trust everybody around you. Okay? And wouldn't it be nice in our regular lives if everywhere we went, we had an attitude of trust? That's not blind trust where we expose ourselves to danger stupidly. Okay, I'm not talking about that. But we come into a situation with a positive, open mind instead of full of preconceptions of all the how horrible other people are and how dangerous everything is. Okay, are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? So if we're very habituated with seeing people as like, we better be very careful, then we really think that's reality, and it's not. Yeah, these are kind, mother sentient beings. And that's why we meditate so much on, you know, the kindness of other sentient beings, because it completely works to switch our attitude towards other people. And in doing so, yeah, we are happier, we communicate better, we give people the benefit of the doubt. You know, it's just our whole life turns out much better. Yeah? Because everywhere you go, then you see kindness. Yeah? So it's our choice. Yeah, and Geshe La keeps saying this, you know, it's our choice, it's our responsibility. Yeah, so I can go to lunch and say, oh, it's beans and cabbage again, you know, and so much carbs, I don't like carbs. And these people are so inconsiderate because they don't realize that I don't eat this stuff and they don't cook something special for me, even though they cook something special for so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, but they don't do it for me. Yeah. And so I can go through my whole life like that. You know, and then and never mind my whole life, lunch is gonna be horrible. I'm gonna be in a bad mood every lunch. You know, not every lunch, but some lunches. But I will go to lunch every day expecting, you know, oh, it's going to be beans and chickpeas or beans and kidney beans or beans and dal. Oh, again, you know, and then just so much bread and carbs and like, don't these people, you know. And then every day my lunch becomes like that. Yeah. Or I could go to lunch every day and say, oh, there's all these kind people who cook lunch, which gave me the opportunity to do some study, yeah, or do some practice. I'm grateful to these people, yeah, the people who offer food to us. Oh, my goodness, I don't have to work a job. These people, out of the kindness of their hearts, are offering food. You know, and then there's other people cooking it. Yeah. And okay, they know for their own good that they don't want me cooking. But, you know, actually I used to be a good cook in my lay life, but that got abandoned. You know, so I could go to lunch thinking, you know, here's all these kind people. Or I could go to lunch like, oh, these people are so inconsiderate. And however I'm thinking, I'm putting that imprint in my mind day after day after day after day. And it's becoming more and more solid. And that's how you create this karmic habituation, which creates the, you know, how, what kind of place we're born in and how we experience it. Okay, so I highly recommend doing the meditation on the kindness of other sentient beings. Yeah, and do it repeatedly. Yeah. It makes sense. It's once you get over the initial hump of, oh, those sentient beings drive me crazy. Once you get over that and really start training your mind again and again and seeing kindness, your whole attitude shifts. I mean, look at His Holiness, how He is around people and how He talks about the Chinese communists. Yeah. He doesn't go, oh, those people invaded my country. How dare they do that? There's genocide, there's environmental destruction. Oh, yeah, we need a war against them. This is terrible. Yeah, if His Holiness did that, he would be so unhappy. And nobody would have even given him the Nobel Peace Prize. Not that he's interested in that. Okay? So it's really up to us what we focus on. Okay, so having said that, let's take a minute and, you know, imagine that we're in the presence of the Buddhas and all the Bodhisattvas and Shantideva, who is there, and he is teaching us personally. You know, when we're reading this text, it is Shantideva personally giving us instruction on how he practices. And all the kind sentient beings around us in human form who are stuck in samsara just as we are and who need our compassion, but who are kind because by their doing whatever they're doing right now, we have the opportunity, the rare opportunity, to sit here and listen to Shantideva. And then to generate your motivation, spend a few minutes thinking of the kindness of other sentient beings, how your whole life, everything you have, everything you know, depends on other living beings. And then use that reflection on kindness to generate bodhicitta, seeing that your attainment of full awakening is the best way to repay that kindness. We're on chapter 4, speeding ahead on chapter 4. So last time we had a few definitions of conscientiousness, which is the title of chapter 4. Okay, so I'm going to find those definitions. And okay, so asanga in Compendium of Knowledge, says, what is conscientiousness? It is an awareness that while abiding with enthusiasm, within non-attachment, non-anger, and non-ignorance, protects one's meditation on virtue and protects the mind from contaminated phenomena. It has the function of being the basis for perfectly accomplishing and completing all ordinary and transcendental perfections. Okay, so non-attachment isn't just the lack of attachment, it's the mind that is repelled by attachment, that isn't interested in those objects of attachment. Non-anger isn't just the absence of anger, it's the mind of love. Non-ignorance isn't just the absence of ignorance, it's the mind of wisdom. Okay, so a mind that is enthusiastic, yeah, free of attachment, anger, and ignorance, possessing renunciation, love, and wisdom, yeah, protects one's meditation on virtue and protects the mind from contaminated or phenomena. I often use polluted instead of contaminated. What that means is that something that arises under the influence of ignorance or the latencies of ignorance. Okay? So something that is a true suffering, a true dukkha, the first of the truth. Okay? And so conscientiousness has the function of being the basis, yeah, for perfectly accomplishing and completing the ordinary perfections and the transcendental perfections. The ordinary perfections are the practices of generosity, ethical conduct, and so on that we do before we realize emptiness. The transcendental perfections are those done by Aryas, okay, who have realized emptiness directly and who see that the agent, object, and action involved in the practice, in practicing the perfections, that all of these are empty and yet depend on each other. Okay? So verse 1, just to read it again using this translation. Okay. Having firmly seized bodhicitta in this way, bodhisattvas must never waver. Always should they exert themselves to never stray from their practice. So we took the generated the bodhisattva, the aspiring bodhicitta, the engaging bodhicitta. We voluntarily took the bodhisattva ethical conduct, and having done that, we should never doubt what we did and hesitate and go, oh, did I do the right thing? Did I do the wrong thing? Okay, so it's, you know, we had an ordination yesterday and also the taking of Anagarika precepts. So, you know, those people have a clear mind. Yeah, that this is what they want to do. So then you don't waver after it later. Yeah. You don't let the afflictions arise and say, oh, but now I can't go and watch the latest movie at the theater. Oh, I'm so deprived, you know. You don't let, if those thoughts start to come in the mind, you cut them. Yeah. And you don't just cut them by repressing them. You cut them by saying, I've been there, done that, got the t-shirt. It doesn't do me any good in this life. It doesn't create any virtue for future lives. It doesn't get me any closer to my spiritual aims. So, you know, let's just leave it aside. I don't need to go to the movies. Or whatever it is, you know, that your mind starts getting preoccupied with. Okay, so it's really important, you know, whatever practice we're doing, that we really stay on it, and you know, because doubt can be so subversive, you know, and just create this amazing confusion in our mind, you know, like, oh, I said I should do this, but I don't know, is Buddhism really the thing for me? I really want to be a bodhisattva. I don't know. I went to the Sufi dancing one time. I felt so exhilarated after doing Sufi dancing. Maybe I should go back to that. But I was raised, you know, Catholic, and I love the sense of the smell of the incense in the church and the feeling of holiness. And I want to go back and have that. And yeah, so then, are you doing any spiritual practice with that mind? Yeah, that mind is a combination of doubt and attachment. Okay, and it doesn't leave you with anything afterwards. You know, you're like in a desert. There, it doesn't leave you with any virtue in your mind at all. Okay. So, verse 2, in the case of reckless actions or deeds not well considered, although a promise may have been made, it is fit to reconsider whether I should do them or not. Okay, so this is saying that it's differentiating the bodhisattva, taking the bodhisattva ethical restraints from doing reckless, impulsive actions or not really thinking things through very well before committing. Okay, so we should be very clear on the difference between these kinds of things. Yeah, reckless actions, it's, you know, this is how we often function. Yeah, an idea comes in our mind and we act it out. Yeah, without thinking about the consequences. So this is, you know, typical of what we did as teenagers, most of us, you know, and it may have continued into adulthood and maybe even into old age, who knows, you know. But, you know, an idea coming in the mind, and that sounds great, let's just go for it. We call it spontaneity, but it's not actually considering the results of what we're doing. It's just, you know, looking for something to distract us from the unhappiness we have right now, you know, and yeah, okay. So those kinds of actions, if when we do them, we get ourselves in a lot of messes. I mean, the inmates that I work with, this is the basic thing that happened to them, you know, some impulsive action that was not well considered, and then winding up, you know, with a sentence that can be anywhere from a few months to the whole rest of your life. Okay, so these kinds of actions that we do impetuously without considering, those, Shantideva is saying, it's fit to reconsider them, you know. Just because I agreed to go with my friend and drive the car when he was going to rob the market, yeah, doesn't mean that now I'm thinking about it again, that I should go ahead and do that because I told him I would do it. Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah, it's like, oh, I said I would do that. Now I'm realizing, no, that's not a good thing to do. Those kind of things, definitely, it's fit to reconsider. It's fit to say, sorry, I can't do that. Yeah. Or, and then other actions that, how did he call them here? Deeds not well considered. So these could be things, you know, and many of us do this. Out of the goodness of our heart, we hear about some wonderful activity and people needing help. And we volunteer, and we say, I want to do it, I want to get involved. But we haven't sat and thought about, do I have the time to do that? Or are other things that I'm doing going to suffer? You know, do I have the ability to do that? You know, will I be able to complete that task if I volunteered to do it? Because it may be something very interesting, yeah, but is it really my priority to get involved in that right now? Or are my other priorities in life different? Okay. And so here we see our tendency to overcommit to things and then not be able to do what we told other people we would do. You know? And then sometimes what we do is we just don't tell them and they're left high and dry. Or we call them, you know, a day or two before the project we're working on, they need to have it and say, oh, sorry, I didn't do it. Okay, which also is very inconvenient for others. Whereas if it would have been actually much wiser on our part to really think, you know, do I have the time? Do I have the ability? Is this, I may have the ability, I may be a little short on time, or I may have the time, but is this really my priority in what I'm doing? Okay, and so to be able to think clearly in our life, what are my priorities, you know? And what are short-term priorities? Oh, I got to cook lunch today. And what are long-term priorities? I'm going for full awakening. And then intermediate priorities, okay? So to be able to hold these things in our mind and evaluate what to do and what not to do, okay? So if we didn't do that and we overcommitted, yeah, then rather than, you know, do a lousy job or not do anything at all and leave the other people high and dry, Shantideva is saying it's fit to reconsider. And then the considerate thing to do is to go to the other person as soon as possible and tell them that we're sorry, we said we would do that, but now upon looking at it further, it doesn't seem like a really wise decision on our part. Okay, so reassessing those things is very fit to do. Reassessing our promise to attain awakening for the benefit of all beings, that is not good to reassess. And Shantideva is going to tell us in the next few verses, you know, the faults of reassessing that and giving it up, okay? Because it isn't just any old promise. It's a commitment to all sentient beings that we made in the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, yeah? So do we really want to go back on something we promised in the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? Do we really want to go back on something that we promised every single sentient being who is looking to us for help? Yeah, do we really want to say, oh, I just thought about it again, and actually, you know, enlightenment is too high, and it takes too long, and it's too difficult, and, you know, I just want to be an arhat, and anyway, you know, I'll get to arhatship eventually. I don't feel any hurry to get out of samsara because there are really all those good movies, you know, that I want to go to and then go out afterwards with my friends to the bar. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. So, sorry, I'm reconsidering bodhicitta. No, we don't do that. Okay. So verse 3, Shantideva is saying to us, I mean, he writes this in the sense like he's talking to himself. And I think that's why I love this so much, is because it gives me a way to talk to myself in a virtuous way and ask myself important questions and examine my own mind. And thinking, well, Shantideva did it this way, so, you know, I can do it this way too. So, Shantideva says, but how can I discard, let me read it from this. But how can I ever withdraw from what has been examined by great wisdom of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and even many times by me myself. Okay, so the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have done a lot of analysis and seen the virtue and the wonder of generating bodhicitta. And we ourselves have spent time thinking about it, doing the meditations to generate bodhicitta, thinking of the benefits of bodhicitta. We ourselves have checked that out. So it's been checked out by our objects of refuge who we respect. It's been checked out by us. Why are we getting cold feet now? Yeah, it's just not suitable for me to withdraw or discard bodhicitta when I've, you know, looked at it so closely. Okay, so, you know, this is very different than some worldly things. I remember there was one person who, and this happens to some people, you know, they get married and then they get divorced, yeah? Or you're together, even you're not married, you're in a committed relationship, then you separate, yeah? And then your mind says, oh, but, I should go back to them, I want to be with them, yeah? And then you go back and you say, oh, but here are all the problems that we can't work out and all the things that aren't working. So I want to separate. And then you separate. And then it's like, oh, but. Okay. So, you know, you can tell in that kind of situation, there hasn't been great wisdom analyzing the situation. Yeah, no, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas haven't analyzed and thought that it's a good thing to do. We ourselves have not analyzed. We're just going pure attachment. One time feeling attached to the person, another time feeling attached to not being with them, and attached to them, and attached to having our own freedom or doing something else or whatever, yeah. And so we're like yo-yos, yeah? Yeah? Have you ever done that? Yeah? Okay, so we know what that's like, you know, having a yo-yo mind. And where has it gotten us? Thank goodness it got us here. But for most people, it doesn't get you to a monastery. Okay. Verse 4, if having made such a promise, I do not put it into action, then by deceiving every living being, what kind of rebirth shall I take? Okay, so if we give up bodhicitta, what kind of rebirth are we going to take? Yeah, is that a virtuous action? Yeah. No, it's not. Is it a light non-virtue or a heavy non-virtue? It's heavy. Yeah. Why is it heavy? Because it's the most virtuous thing you could possibly do, and now you're throwing it away. And it's something that you promised to do in the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and now you're throwing that away. And it's something that you even told all the sentient beings you were going to do, and now you're going back on them. Okay. As kids, we had some nasty term we called people. Oh, yeah, it was one of those racist terms. I won't use it. Okay. But it was, yeah, it was a racist term, wasn't it? So, but it was a term. It has the meaning of, you know, you promise something and then you back out of it. Yeah. So this kind of thing, it's really not suitable to do that. Okay. So having made this promise, if I don't put it into action, then I've deceived every living being. Okay. Now, okay, you may say, well, you know, everybody deceives people. Okay, look at what is happening to our country because of people in power deceiving the public. And that's only one country. It's a lot of sentient beings, but compared to countless sentient beings, it's not so many. But look at the pain and suffering it causes by deceiving others. Yeah? That is not going to create, because, you know, and if we deceive all sentient beings by giving up bodhicitta, yeah, what kind of rebirth are we creating for ourselves? Yeah. So verse 5, okay, so that verse is really stating, you know, what kind of rebirth we're going to have. The next couple of verses are the supporting evidence for why that will happen. So verse 5 says, if it has been taught by the Buddha that those who do not give away the smallest thing that they once intended to give will take rebirth as hungry ghosts, then if I should deceive all beings after having sincerely invited them to the unsurpassed bliss, shall I take a happy rebirth? Okay, so it's been taught by the Buddha in the teachings, probably on karma and on generosity, that if we have the intention to give something to someone, and then we don't follow through, we decide to keep it ourselves, we decide to give it to somebody else. Okay, so it's like a form of stealing, because in our mind we've given it, and then we've taken it back. So here we've given our promise to benefit all sentient beings, to all those sentient beings, and now we're taking it back. So if promising, having the intention to give something away and then not giving it, and it involves just even a small thing, if that's going to create the cause for rebirth as a hungry ghost, because hungry ghosts don't have, they're deprived of the possessions they need through their karma, if that happens, then what's going to be the karmic result of deciding to give our benefit to all sentient beings and then withdrawing it? Okay, not good. So this is also something to be aware of in our actions. How often we mentally give something and then we decide not to afterwards. You know, we reconsider. We have this spontaneous thing of, you know, well, I'll give my chocolate bar away. And then the mind says, but then I won't have it. Yeah. Or I'll give this away. Oh, but I may need it. Or, oh, I'll give this to so-and-so. And then you think, no, actually, I like that person better. I want to give it to them. Okay. So, you know, if we intend to give something to someone, we should follow through with that action. Unless it's one of those things that is going to damage somebody else. Yeah. Oh, I promised to bring that alcoholic another bottle of booze. Oh, well, that wasn't such a good thing to intend to give to somebody. So that kind of thing you can withdraw, but otherwise. Okay. So if I should deceive all beings after sincerely inviting them to the unsurpassed bliss, I've invited, you know, when we take the Bodhisattva vow, we imagine like it's a big festival in a way, because here are all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, all the sentient beings are there, they're cheering us on. Okay, it's like a big festival, and I invited all the sentient beings to come and be the witness to my making, the, you know, taking the Bodhisattva ethical restraints and which is going to lead them to the unsurpassable bliss, because when I become Buddha, then I can really work for their benefit. Okay, and I sincerely invited them. And now I'm going, yeah. It's kind of like inviting everybody to the Rose Garden for a big festival and then giving them COVID. Shall I take a happy rebirth? It's similar, isn't it? You invite people and then you don't take proper precautions, and then a bunch of people come down with a possibly deadly illness after you invited them there, and they thought, oh, this is wonderful, it's such an honor to be there. I mean, backing out of Bodhisattva vows is like worse, way, way worse than that. It's amazing how good analogies pop up in the news, isn't it? Sad analogies. Okay, so then verse 7. Only the omniscient can discern the manner of the action of those who give up bodhicitta but are freed. It is beyond the scope of ordinary thought. Okay, so what's happening here is this is talking about a situation in which somebody has generated bodhicitta, they gave it up, but they still manage to not go to the hell realms but attain arhatship. Okay, so how in the world does that happen, especially given what we've understood through the last few verses? And the example here is Shariputra. Okay, so Shariputra, you know, he was the Buddha's disciple foremost in wisdom. And it looks like at one point he generated bodhicitta. And then a demon asked him for his right hand. So he cut off his right hand and with his left hand handed it to the demon. In Indian culture, your left hand is the one you use to clean yourself because they don't have toilet paper. So you never eat with your left hand. If you're left-handed, be aware of this when you go to India, because it's still a strong custom. Yeah? So you never eat with your left hand. You never give anything to somebody with your left hand. If you're giving your passport to the people who check you in at immigration, you give it with the right hand. Okay? So this demon was offended, you know. I wanted his right hand and he handed it to me with his left hand. How, you know, discourteous. Well, what's he supposed to do? You know, put it on his foot and toss it into the air and then you catch it? But anyway, so this demon got very, very upset. And Shariputra just said, what's the use of helping sentient beings? Yeah, this guy wanted my hand. I gave it to him in good faith. He couldn't, you know, forego his caste system thing and take it from me. And, you know, helping these sentient beings is just, it's too hard. You know, these sentient beings are hopeless. Yeah, have you ever had that feeling? Sometimes, like when you try and help somebody, and they throw it back in your face and curse, you know, swear at you and tell you to get out of here and mind your own business. And you're saying, but I'm just trying to help you. Yeah. So you get frustrated and you just throw it away and say, forget it. You know, okay, you feel that way. I'm not going to generate bodhicitta for you. I'm not going to go through all this headache of becoming a Buddha for you when you don't even appreciate when I'm trying to give you something nice. Yeah. So it's really, it's a story to make us look at how frustrated we get and how much expectation we have when we do even a small helpful action. Yeah. I reached out and I helped you move from one place to the other place on a Saturday afternoon when I could have been relaxing and doing my own laundry. And you don't even say thank you at the end of the day for me sacrificing my Saturday to help you, my good friend, move flats. Yeah. As certainly, you know, what are we, it's like we won a Nobel Prize for helping a friend, you know. It should be recognized and I should be praised and credited, and you should write on your Facebook thing, so-and-so helped me move apartments on Saturday afternoon instead of doing their own laundry and relaxing. What a sacrifice. Yeah. It's amazing how our mind works, isn't it? Yeah. So, yeah. So we, you know, so people hear, you know, what happened to Shariputra, and he, you know, gave the whole bodhisattva ideal up, and yet he became a, you know, he wasn't became an arhat. Well, how is that possible? Okay. That because we just got through with these verses saying, you know, somebody goes directly to the hell realm. Okay, so this verse is saying that it is a karmic thing that has to do with his whole karmic, I don't know what you call it. Yeah, right, his whole karmic portfolio. Yeah, that somehow he managed to attain arhatship and didn't go to hell by giving up bodhicitta. Okay, so it's like, okay, this is some exception, but don't count on it in your own case if you give up bodhicitta. Okay, this happened to Shariputra in an extreme situation, and it's something only a Buddha can understand karmically, but you aren't Shariputra, so don't think of it. There's an interesting story when you read Achan Moon's biography. Remember, he had once generated bodhicitta, and then in a previous life, and then in this life, he thought, oh, but if I keep that bodhisattva promise, I will not attain arhatship in this life. And so he gave it up, and yet he managed to become an arhat. Okay, so again, his karmic portfolio, so to speak, is something that is incomprehensible to beings like us. Yeah. So this, for a bodhisattva, is the heaviest of downfalls, for should it ever happen, the welfare of all will be weakened. Okay, so here we're talking about the disadvantages of giving up bodhicitta. It interferes with the well-being of all sentient beings. Now you can think, but, you know, I'm just an ordinary sentient being. I wasn't benefiting that many people. My giving up bodhicitta is, you know, it's not really depriving them of much because all I am capable of giving to them now is some popcorn if I'm in a good mood. So, you know, it's not that harmful. But yes, it is, you know, even though we're a limited being, because when we make that promise and you know, say and adopt those ethical restraints, we're setting ourselves on a path to be of enormous benefit to sentient beings. More than giving them popcorn if we're in a good mood, okay? So backing out of that, even though we aren't capable of giving like a bodhisattva or a Buddha right now, we're on the path to being able to do that, and we'll continually become more and more able to do that as we practice. But we're cutting all of that short, that potential benefit, temporal and ultimate benefit we could give to sentient beings by giving up bodhicitta. Okay, so in that way, it damages all the sentient beings. So all the sentient beings that we'll meet in our next life that we don't know in this lifetime, they're not going to receive the aid that they could have if we had kept our bodhicitta motivation and not given it up. Okay? So it has far-reaching consequences, which we may not see immediately, but they bring about. And so this is one of the problems that we sentient beings have. If we don't see an immediate result, we don't think that result exists. Okay? So sometimes we create negative karma. There's no immediate horrible result. And then we say, well, you know, nothing bad is going to happen. And anyway, I'm really not sure if other realms exist. Yeah, well, okay, the animal realm exists, but how can I ever be reborn as an animal? That's ridiculous. So I did this action. It wasn't so good, but there wasn't any immediate bad thing that happened, so not a big deal. This is the exact same way that people are reacting towards climate change. Yeah? It's like, we don't see it right now, so it's not going to happen. Warming the world, you know. Oh, what's happening right now, the dryness in California and all up and down the West Coast. That's not climate change. That's just a regular drought. We'll come out of it. We'll have normal rains. So, you know, okay, it's not so nice that all these forests burn, but, you know, it's not something we need to worry about in the long term. And anyway, recycling is really too inconvenient. And not getting in my car and driving where I want to go when I want to go there, that's really too much of a sacrifice for me to make. The same way of thinking, isn't it? If I don't see an immediate result, well, then there's not going to be a bad result that comes. So why worry? Yeah, and the climate, and you have all these climate scientists, you know, telling us why we should worry, just like Shanti Deva's telling us why we should worry if we give up bodhicitta. Yeah, some people, what do those climate scientists know? They don't know anything. Scientists don't know anything. Yeah, I am not a hidden genius. What?
Stable genius.
Yeah. So just trust me, my hunches, my intuition, always very good. For me. Not for you, but for me. But that's good enough. Okay. So I want to be very clear. When I'm saying these things that seem very political, I am saying them so that we look at our mind and how we are similar. Okay? So I'm not just pointing my finger at somebody else going, that kind of he did, da, 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 da. You know, I'm saying, yeah, do you do that like that? Yeah? I mean, this person is an extreme example. But those same actions, do we do? Yeah. So we better clean up our act. Because if we keep putting those kind of seeds in our mind, we may wind up like being like that. Ooh. Okay. So giving up bodhicitta, yeah. It weakens the welfare of all beings. It harms all sentient beings. And it's the same as, as when we obstruct the virtuous actions of bodhisattvas. Yeah. So one of the things they say is very negative karma is to interfere with the actions of bodhisattvas. Yeah, or criticize bodhisattvas' virtuous deeds. Yeah, so verse 9 talks about that. And should others, for even a single moment, hinder or obstruct there, the bodhisattva's, wholesome deeds by weakening the welfare of all, there will be no end to their rebirth in lower states. So that is, he's saying, and should others even do that? It really means, should I? Yeah. So if I, for even a single moment, hinder or obstruct the wholesome deeds of the bodhisattvas, yeah, that will weaken the welfare of all beings, because those bodhisattvas are working for the benefit of all beings and I'm interfering with it. So all the sentient beings who could benefit are being deprived of that. So, you know, what kind of rebirth am I going to get from that? You know, one in which there's going to, he says there's no end to lower states. There is always an end, but he's saying it for emphasis, okay? So, so one sutra says, it is heavier to obstruct the virtue of a bodhisattva who is offering one instance of food or drink to an animal than to rob all sentient beings in the world of their food and kill them. Okay, so that's something we should be careful of. And then, you know, because they say that we never know who's a bodhisattva and who's not, be careful who you criticize, be careful when you interfere. So yes, it's always good to be careful when we interfere. It's always good to be careful before we criticize. But that doesn't mean just becoming passive and sitting there and saying, well, I don't know, they could all be bodhisattvas. You know, those two people, you know, beating each other up in the street, it could just be Kala Rupa and Mahakala playing together. So I shouldn't break them up. Yeah. So I wouldn't really count on thinking like that as being the way to handle that situation, you know? Okay, it may be Kala Rupa and Mahakala just having fun on an afternoon, but to the common appearance, it's two sentient beings creating a lot of negative karma and harming each other physically. And in that situation, without being angry, it's definitely appropriate for us to intervene in some way and stop it. Yeah. How to stop it? That's a good question. There was one woman who came to stay here very early on, and she had such interesting ways of thinking and doing things. And I'm trying to think of what she did. She saw two people once fighting in a public situation, or a man beating a woman in a public situation. And she just went in there and started acting like a crazy person, screaming at him to stop. She didn't touch him. She stayed away, but screamed at him and acting like a crazy person. And eventually, the guy kind of was so shocked by that behavior that he stopped. Or she did, you know, these crazy things like, you know, they're fighting and she would just pick up his backpack and run away with it, and then he's distracted, and you know. But what I'm getting at is there are creative ways to interfere that don't involve physically harming the other person or putting yourself in danger. Yeah, and if I ever meet her again, I'm going to ask her to tell more of those stories and write them down, because they were very useful in thinking, you know, in bad situations, how to deal with them. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's also calling 911, but sometimes that too is dangerous. So, yeah. Okay, so then verse 10 tells the reason for that. Yeah. So, if my being is impaired by destroying the joy of even one creature, then what need is there to mention destroying the joy of creatures vast as space? Okay, so if I give up bodhicitta, I'm destroying all of those living beings' joy. If I'm interfering with the deeds of a bodhisattva, I'm also interfering with the well-being of, you know, living beings in infinite space. And I've told this story before, but I feel it's a very helpful story. When many of you are aware of the Maitreya Project in Bodh Gaya and in Kushinagar. Yeah, and I think they moved it back to Bodh Gaya, didn't they? Anyway, there were some people who, Buddhists, who were very unhappy about that, saying that the project was buying up the land of the poor farmers, and then where are those farmers going to go, and why do we need such an expensive statue? Why not give the money to creating schools and hospitals and things that people need in this life? So there were people criticizing for that reason. Yeah. And so somebody went to see Geshe Jumpa Tetchok and asked him, you know, about that kind of thing. And he was so skillful, yeah. He just said, you know, if I had that much money, here's how I would use it. So he didn't criticize the building of the Maitreya Stupa, you know, because it is virtuous. He didn't criticize that at all. But he just said, you know, if I had those resources, you know, I would use them in a different way. Okay, so you see there's a difference there between criticizing somebody and trashing them for what they're doing or criticizing an action and saying, in this case, if you were in a similar situation, how you would do it. Okay, do you see the difference there? Yeah, but it's interesting because we normally go to criticizing what somebody else did instead of saying, this is how I would do it. So we see that in the election a lot, both sides criticizing the other side. I think sometimes it is important not to criticize the person, but if a policy isn't working, to talk about how that policy falls short. That is different from criticizing the person. And definitely stating what policy you would institute is also really, that would be very, very beneficial. Okay. All this trashing of people is really quite unpleasant. Okay, are there questions so far?
Yeah. I have one question for myself and one question from online.
Okay.
In Gyatsob Jay's commentary to verse 8, so just above where you were reading the other quote, he has one paragraph that I'm not exactly sure what it means, and it says, as it is stated, if a bodhisattva with vows gives up bodhicitta, he receives a root downfall. If he has no vows, then his negativity is still heavier than the root downfall of the vows of individual liberation. Mm-hmm. So when it says, if he has no vows...
Okay, wait a minute. Where?
The bottom of page 118.
Okay, so as it is stating, if a bodhisattva with vows, okay, gives up bodhicitta, he receives a root downfall. Okay, so if you have, you've taken the engaged bodhicitta, okay, if you give up bodhicitta, that's a root downfall of the bodhisattva ethical restraints, okay? If he has no vows, okay, and so it's hard to imagine a bodhisattva with no vows, meaning no bodhisattva vows, because the generating of engaging bodhicitta is simultaneous with entering the bodhisattva path of accumulation. Okay, so I'm not sure how there could be a bodhisattva without vows. You know, maybe it's talking, because many times what people do, and this is often done in the Chinese community, is people who have taken the bodhisattva ethical restraints, they're called bodhisattvas, you know, to kind of encourage them, but they aren't real bodhisattvas. So maybe Gyaltsen Jay is doing that here. I don't know.
I want, sir.
Yeah, but in any case, giving up bodhicitta is more negative than breaking a root pratimoksha vow.
Thank you. I just wondered whether it meant if he has no pratimoksha vows. I don't know. I was a bit confused. Anyway, thank you. That's clear. The question from online.
Yeah, it could mean if he has no vows. It could mean if he has no pratimoksha vows. It's a bit vague. Yeah, but either way, I think you get the point. Okay.
And then online, someone is asking, could Venerable please explain how to balance between seeing the world as a pure land and developing renunciation by seeing the suffering of samsara? How to balance those two views?
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, the key is to realize that things are empty of inherent existence. Of course, that is a very high realization. But just even intellectually, understanding that as soon as we perceive something in a certain way, we reify it and we think it is an objective reality out there, untouchable, that we are seeing. Yeah? So if you hold that very strongly, then when you imagine a pure land, it's an inherently existent pure land, which means it can never be contaminated. And if it's a rubbish pit so that you can generate renunciation, then it's an inherently existent rubbish pit. And if it's kind of nice and I like to play with it and I don't want renunciation, then it's, you know, an inherently existent my life, with all its pleasure in it, okay? So the difficulty we come to is because we think that however we think of something, that's the only one way any reasonable person could see it, because that is objectively real. So the ability to see, you know, things as in the nature of dukkha, and then also to imagine being in a pure land, if you hold inherent existence, you're going to have problems with that. Yeah. But if you realize that all of those things can be true at the same time, depending on your mental state and what details you're picking out to look at, then you can see how both things fit in. Okay? Because the question sometimes comes, like in Tantra, well, if I see everybody, if I see this as a pure land, then there's no suffering sentient beings in it. So, you know, why do I need to generate bodhicitta? because none of them are suffering sentient beings revolving in samsara, because we're all in a pure land. Well, my imagining being in a pure land doesn't make everybody in a pure land, because they aren't thinking like that at that moment. Just as, let's say there's somebody who is mentally ill, who is, having a paranoid schizophrenic event that appears so real to them, but it doesn't appear that way to everybody else. Okay? But you can see, if somebody has the karma, even something as innocuous as a clock for set to a certain time can induce a flashback and a hallucination or whatever. And that happens, doesn't it? Yeah, if somebody experienced a trauma at a certain time, or somebody was in a certain situation and experienced a strong trauma, just being in another situation that even resembles that first one a little bit can cause this whole flashback thing happening, yeah? And so what we're really getting at is how our mind creates our experience. And if we can, in any situation, say, I can see it this way, I can also see it this way, I can also see it this way. And this is the whole idea behind thought training too. The whole thing about transforming adversity into the path. You're facing a situation that to you looks horrible, totally negative. And then the mind training tells us how to look at it in a different way. And then it becomes something conducive for our Dharma practice. And it's no longer something that is so terrible to go through. But the external situation didn't change at all. Okay? So it's the same thing here, from the perspective of an ordinary being looking at samsara. I mean, yeah, it's in the nature of dukkha, and it's something to be renounced. Yeah, for somebody who is imagining, being in the pure land, it doesn't mean they're in a real pure land at that moment. Okay. They're creating that in their mind and realizing the possibility of that kind of thing happening in the future, but they're not grasping onto it as inherently existent. Okay. And this is, some of the problem that, when you hear see your guru as the Buddha, this is the problem people get into. Oh, my guru is now an inherently existent Buddha. But he doesn't know the instructions of how to get from here to Spokane. Then how can he be omniscient? Okay? So, yeah, when we imbue everything with inherent existence, then we don't know how to understand a lot of these teachings and how they can be very good for our mind if we have this more flexible, expansive view. But let me tell you, I'm still in the process of expanding my mind to that. And it's taken decades to try and understand this, simply because the mind so quickly goes to, but what I'm seeing is 100% reality and there is none other. And that's not it. Okay, so, somebody who's a bodhisattva, or somebody who's a Buddha, let's say, a Buddha manifests here. To a Buddha, they see, infinite purity. They see everybody as kind. They have good feelings towards everybody. But they also see that these are sentient beings with minds that are totally corrupted by afflictions. Yeah, and they're working for their benefit. They don't say, these beings, I've been doing tantra for a long time, kind of, you know, this one who started the Second World War, you know, Adolf Hitler, he would, you know, he's just, you know, Yamantaka, and, you know, I should go bow down to him. You know, it doesn't mean that you concretize everything. Okay?
Yeah, even on a worldly level, when you have trauma and such, even psychotherapy works with some kind of form of mind training. It's cognitive behavioral therapy called. Mm-hmm. So you turn your mind, you recognize that you have cognitive constructions that are not quite with reality. So you learn that, and it's a long training. And also, I wanted to say, the Bodhisattva vows come normally after you have taken Pratimoksha vows. Mm-hmm. And so the Pratimoksha vows are really, really helpful. I strongly recognize that what kind of responsibility I hold when, I'm holding when having the vows towards society. And you always emphasize again and again, we are the conscience of society. So people look up on us. And I even remembered when I was a teenager and I was drinking, you know, like teenagers do, experiencing some teenagers. And then there was a moment where I started to smoke hashish or something. Mm-hmm. And then I told my girlfriend, and she started to cry, and she said, don't do that. And so, because there's this kind of, we have responsibility. And that was my first experience where I recognized I have an effect on others. You know, so even on that worldly level, when we are in a restaurant and we drink beer or wine, it affects people around us. Or when we don't pay the ticket for the bus or whatever, it affects people. Every action we are doing, and monastics have these strong reglements, you know, these guidelines. And so we are training already our mind to give a good example, you know, mm-hmm. to peace, to calm our own mind and satisfy or not, and be more virtuous, and then that has a strong impact on others.
Yeah.
So,
very much. Yeah. Thank you. Can you think of anything better to do than studying Shantideva? Yeah. Even you wake up in a bad mood, when you come and you sit down and you read this text, you cannot stay in a bad mood.